From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago, the Earth off the coast of Japan shook deep and hard for 6 minutes. In the nuclear power world and Japanese lives, the aftershocks are still being felt. The quake last March 11th brought a monster tsunami. The tsunami slammed the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant and led to a terrifying triple meltdown. As the crisis mounted, the Japanese government thought it might have to evacuate even Tokyo, the world's largest city. Today, almost all of Japan's nuclear power plants are closed. It has been a rough year. This hour on Point, the lessons of Fukushima. We'll hear in a moment from the man who is overseeing a major independent investigation into the meltdown at Fukushima, its buildup, and its aftermath. Let's listen back, though, for a moment to the sounds of that time. This was a press conference in Tokyo, March 18th, last year. Japanese then Prime Minister Naoto Kan saying through an interpreter that workers were still trying to cool fuel rods at the big nuclear plants.
The situation surrounding the accident is still very grave. In order to overcome this crisis, the police, fire department, self-defense forces, and other groups are all working together, putting their lives on the line.
We had no idea at that time exactly how deeply, how many were putting their lives on the line, or really how serious the crisis was. Here's a resident of Tokyo from March 17th last year expressing concern. Everybody didn't exactly know. Hear about radiation levels in the air.
Now the air, the radiation is higher than normal, and the normal, I think, should be zero, but now it's much higher. So now I think things is just getting worse.
On March 16th last year, the then 77-year-old Emperor of Japan, Akihito, voiced here grave concern over the country's nuclear crisis.
The accident at nuclear power plant causes deep worry, and I hope the efforts by staff can avert the situation getting worse.
They ultimately did prevent it getting worse, but this was close and remained close for a long time. On March 22nd, with the plant leaking radiation into the atmosphere, the Japanese government, in a desperate attempt to cool those reactors, flew helicopters over the plant, dropped seawater on the exposed core. Here's a BBC News report on that operation.
Military helicopters hovering overhead to drop tons of seawater directly where it's needed. The twin intention to try to cool the reactors and to replenish water in a pool that holds spent nuclear fuel rods. The threat from the radioactivity has meant the helicopters have had to be fitted with a protective lead plate and to stay high enough to safeguard the aircrew.
Japan and the world had little idea just how serious this all was. In a moment, Yoichi Funabashi joined us, a major figure in the aftermath, looking to figure out what went on in his country, in Japan. With us right now from Tokyo is Ken Kukie. He's the Japan correspondent for The Economist magazine. He's been following all this ever since the crisis first began to unfold. Ken, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tom.
So here we are, nearly a year on now. I'm looking here at a contract, $13 billion contract that's been given to clean up 8,000 square miles around this plant. That's practically the size of our American state of New Jersey. In the immediate surrounding area of Fukushima, the power plants, what's the situation? Have people been able to move back, been able to resume their livelihoods or not, Ken?
It depends where. Close to the reactor in what's called the exclusion zone, which is a 20-kilometer radius of the reactor, the answer is no. They are forbidden to return. They've been able to go back once or twice for just a small little incursion so that they could actually get some of their belongings, a safe, money, other things, that things that they may have left behind when they evacuated either, you know, that day or the day of or the next subsequent days following that. There is a plume to the northwest of Fukushima that looks like a sort of arrow going up that goes beyond that area, that 20-kilometer radius, and that, too, is sort of a selective, there's a term for it, not quite the exclusion zone, but it's a little bit more of an selective evacuation zone where people have left as well because there's these hot spots. Generally, however, there's other areas where things are trying to resume to normal. I was in Fukushima City recently, which is not close to the reactor, by the way, although it shares the same name because it's the name of the prefecture as well. And there you saw pregnant women, you saw little children. Is it safe? Depends who you talk to. In the short term, it probably is. In the long term, and of course, if you're a resident, if you're a child growing up there, that's considered the long term, it might not be.
And we're seeing reports here just in the last couple of months of traces of radioactive cesium in Japanese baby formula, 400,000 cans recalled as a precaution, reports of radioactive particles making their way into vegetables and beef and fish and the staple of Japan, rice. What about food in Japan and the Japanese? Do they see it as safe? Is it safe? Do we know?
It's a very difficult issue. At the outset, the most important thing to realize is that we are going to be finding cesium everywhere. We're going to find radioisotopes everywhere, and that's not because they pose a danger. It's because the instrumentation is just so good. It is so sensitive that we can pick out radiation anywhere. Hence, you're probably going to find radiation in the Bay of San Francisco from Fukushima. In fact, it's certain that you will. Again, because the instrumentation can find it. It's not harmful to human health, for example, if you're in San Francisco, in the same way that if you take a small breath of air and you're having secondhand smoke from someone nearby, you're not going to die tomorrow. That's fine. However, you broach a difficult issue. It turns out that the food supply, there is a worry about it because there's uncertainties and because it hasn't been as secured and locked down as it needs to be. Let me give you an example. The way that the labeling laws work for milk is that the milk is labeled from where the distribution center is, not from the farms where the cows were based. So if you take milk from Fukushima and bring them to a different prefecture, you label it with the distribution center, not with the Fukushima farm. That makes no sense. That's irrational. It might even be wrong-headed. However, that's the law. Secondly, when you have measure the milk, you measure it as it's about to come out and go into cartons before you ship it. So if there were to be contaminated farms, you would know, because you'll be measuring it, that in fact the milk is getting diluted, and as a result the stuff that's being shipped out is going to be safe for human consumption because it's going to be low enough that that amount of cesium is not going to be a problem. That too is irrational. What I think a more enlightened policy would be, and I think the Japanese people themselves would agree, is you want to do testing at the farm level, not at the level of these large cooling stations.
Ken, let me ask you, if I may, because we have so many issues to touch here. May I ask you about evacuees? I've read numbers anywhere from 80,000 to 160,000 people still not back in their homes. Do you know what the number is today?
Yeah, the number that I see is 340,000 people are in temporary housing. That includes about a quarter of a million from just the tsunami and earthquake and the rest from the Fukushima.
That's an amazing number. And another amazing number, all but two of Japan's 55 nuclear plants shut down or not operating now. Is that a how has that happened? And how does Japan, which was so dependent on nuclear energy, how do they get along without any at this point? I think all but the last one or two, and those two are closing down soon. How is Japan managing on the energy front?
Right. So they are managing well, but it comes at a price. What they've done is they've taken plants that were coal-fired plants or geothermal plants or hydroelectricity plants that had either been at low-level capacity or, of course, shuttered because they didn't need it because it was old, and they've brought it back online. They have to buy a lot more fossil fuels. They have to buy liquid natural gas from Russia. So at a time when you might want to think you're weaning yourself away from the Russian bear, they have to embrace it with even more gusto. The reason why the plants are closed is because of a small quirk in the Japanese nuclear policy. The plants undergo a safety check every 13 months. That's about twice as quickly as plants in Europe or in America.
Yep.
By doing so, to reactivate, they have to get the approval of the local governors, and the local governors have not signed off on it. So although these are being scheduled downtime for scheduled maintenance, they're not being restarted. And it's true, Japan went from 25% nuclear dependence on March 10th to almost zero today. There's two nuclear power plants, and in the next 2 or 3 months, those two will presumably be shuttered for scheduled maintenance, and if none others restart, it will be a nuclear-free nation.
Amazing. And we're going to hear in just a moment from the very distinguished Yoichi Funabashi, who's leading this independent investigation, has led. They say that the world, Japan, really had little idea how close the country came to total disaster. Explain that to us.
You know, it's not just the world, it's not just the American forces and military and President Obama, it's the Japanese political class as well. Even the prime minister was not given accurate information, timely information, disclosed by TEPCO, who was running the plant. It's a strange quirk of Japan that there's a lot of factionalism or sectionalism, that there's people who are in the know and who are not.
What almost happened, though, Ken? What almost happened?
What almost happened? The meltdown began. The prime minister was probably not fully aware of the severity of the crisis. He had an inkling of it, but because maybe the radiation measurement readings were incomplete, he was given incomplete information, or he was told that we don't have the information because it's not quite, it's not verified yet. Funabashi-san knows all of the details of exactly what was going on during those days, and he'll tell you this in a moment. So what happened was Natsu Kan, the prime minister, had to sort of improvise and orchestrate his own response. This is difficult in Japan. In America, we have leaders and we give them the responsibility to make difficult decisions and sometimes think out of the box. And particularly, the law allows them to do that. He's got emergency acts that he can activate.
In Japan, it wasn't so much. Ken Kukie, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're going to come back and hear from the top guy in the big independent investigation of what happened at Fukushima. Listeners, you can join us a year on. Are you still haunted by the images, the massive tsunami, the haunted faces of the Japanese? This is On Point. We'll be right back. Just a year ago this month, the world was wondering what was going on. Many in Japan didn't know. Here's Fox News looking on March 22nd. This is Martha McCallum.
Well, radiation levels now 1,600 times higher than normal. 1,600 times, and that goes up to 12 miles from Japan's crippled nuclear power plant. That zone has already been evacuated, and now folks within 18 miles of the leaking facility are being urged to stay indoors upon fear of radiation as smoke is seen rising from a second damaged reactor.
Smoke rising, and who knew exactly how deep the damage was? Ken Kukie of The Economist in Tokyo joins us today. Also joining us right now from Tokyo is Yoichi Funabashi. He is chairman of the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, a group that just wrapped up an extensive independent investigation into the nuclear crisis and what went wrong. Mr. Funabashi is the former editor-in-chief of Japan's Asahi Shimbun newspaper and one of the country's most prominent public intellectuals. He is certainly in Japan's spotlight right now. Yoichi Funabashi in Tokyo, thank you for joining us. Welcome to On Point. We're very grateful to you for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've taken on a big task in bringing an independent eye to what happened at Fukushima. If we could just take up the issue of how close Japan came to something much worse, what was that most vulnerable moment, Mr. Funabashi, when things could have turned out much worse than they did?
I think the most vulnerable point was perhaps the spent fuel rod in Unit 4 of Fukushima Daiichi started to melt down. Because the spent fuel pool was not covered sufficiently and defended by the power vessel as well as the containment vessel. So once the radiation would have been released, that would have been released directly into the air, and it could contaminate the whole the environment. So when we had that Unit 4 spent fuel pool was in serious situation, I think that was one of the most precarious moments.
You quote the chief cabinet secretary of Japan warning that if that kind of demonic chain reaction got going, that it could in fact lead to the necessity of evacuating Tokyo.
Yes, exactly. That resulting plume of radiation actually could ultimately have necessitated the complete evacuation of Tokyo metropolitan area. So that actually that worst case scenario drawn up by Dr. Kondo Shunsuke, Japan's Atomic Energy Commission chairman, who was commissioned by instructed secretly by Prime Minister Kan draw up. And in that report, the report projected this worst-case scenario.
What would the consequences have been for Japan? And this was a close call. What would the consequences have been if that evacuation and contamination of Tokyo had taken place, Mr. Funabashi?
Well, I think that's mission impossible. Even though they came up with this worst-case scenario, they could not do anything how to respond to this worst-case scenario, because to evacuate 30 million people from Tokyo metropolitan area is simply impossible. So, but the imagined worst-case scenario was far closer than anyone would wish to admit.
That was forestalled, and the damage was contained through a lot of heroic effort on the part of workers for the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO. But you describe in your report how TEPCO wanted to pull them out, and it was the direct intervention at very early in the morning, sort of 5 a.m., of the prime minister going to the power company and saying, do not pull them out, that permitted them to go back in and do the heroic, take the heroic measures that saved this from a much worse scenario. How do you judge the importance of the prime minister's action at that moment, Funabashi-san?
I think that was very crucial. Even though Prime Minister Khan may have made many lapses and misjudgments, but I think at that critical juncture, I think Prime Minister Khan did exactly what he was supposed to do, and that was he confronted the company's top management with an injunction not to abandon ship and demand for that establishment of Joint Response Headquarters at TEPCO's main office. So he did not allow TEPCO to just withdraw their workers at the most critical juncture, and I think that was a right decision, and I think that he saved the nation.
Why was Japan so slow in communicating with itself and with the world about exactly what was going on at Fukushima?
I think, first of all, there are so many unknowns, and I do not think that Prime Minister Khan and his team were trying to hide anything from the world. Actually, they are very much slow of appreciating what was going on the ground, simply because they could not get that information in timely fashion. And TEPCO actually was not forthcoming. But even at the TEPCO's headquarters, they were also very much unaware of what had been going on the ground, because all the gauges, were almost out of operation and stopped working, and the communication was down, and you just cannot communicate each other, and so there are so many fogs, just like the fogs in a war zone, on the ground, on those most critical days.
A kind of fog of war, in this case, nuclear crisis. Yuichi Funabashi, you have taken your mandate to look into this investigation, actually gone very deep. You said that Japan has to look at it, at its how its leadership works, at its own culture, to understand how this vulnerability could have been tolerated in the first place. Why do you think these plants were allowed to sit there right on the coast? We now see vulnerable to tsunami and all the threats that ensued. Why was this permitted in the first place?
Yeah, Tom, I think it's a really crucial question. I think, for one, the Japanese nuclear industry became ensnared in its own twisted myth of absolute safety.
You say a myth of absolute safety, mythology.
Absolute safety, mm-hmm. Yes, and which has been actually propagated by interest groups seeking to gain broad acceptance for nuclear power. For instance, the utility company's aversion to actions, smacking of preparations for a potential nuclear disaster, meant that development of robots designed to assist in nuclear accidents was never pursued.
Robots, mm-hmm.
Robots,
they didn't do it.
You know, even though Japan was very much noted for its very much advancement and excelling at robotics, yet robots, especially designed for use in nuclear accidents, was never pursued, and no utilities was interested in purchasing that.
Do you think that the Japanese government was too weak to have better oversight, or too friendly to the nuclear industry, or simply blind to the threat? What?
I think so. All of them. All of that reasons combined. I think at its core, the Japan's nuclear safety regime was so hollow, phony even. Regulators pretend to be regulated. Utilities pretend to be regulated. So in reality, the regulators were far more powerful in knowledge, expertise, and political clout.
You know the United States pretty well. You know Japan very well. Is Japan alone in having this kind of hollow safety, phony safety around its nuclear industry? Or do you imagine or know that that's a problem in other countries as well?
I'm not too familiar with the United States case, but I can assume that there are some similar problems involved in a regulator's relationship with a regulated. The regulated often are more powerful politically and financially over that regulators, and regulator captive phenomenon actually is more or less pervasive and even universal in any country in the world.
Yoichi Funabashi is with us from Tokyo. He is head of a big independent investigation that has gone on into the Fukushima meltdown. Ken Kukie is with us from The Economist in Japan as well. We have questions from our listeners, Mr. Funabashi, if you would. David's calling from York, Maine. David, you're on the air with Mr. Funabashi.
Yeah, hi, Tom. My question is this. As I understand what happened with this disaster, the plant itself, the nuclear power plant itself, withstood the earthquake, which was an enormous earthquake.
Yes.
It then withstood the tidal waves, the 30 and 40 foot tidal waves that hit. And what didn't go right was that the generators that powered the pumps that pumped water in to keep the reactor cool, they failed because they had not been hardened properly. And in fact, that if they had been secured underground or elsewhere, we wouldn't even be talking about this disaster. We'd be talking about how amazing it is,
yes,
that this nuclear power plant withstood this this enormous natural disaster. So it seems to me that rather than shut down the nuclear power industry in Japan and in Germany and elsewhere around the world, this would be a great time to double down on it, to realize that it really was, it was a minor problem that led to a major disaster. Don't get me wrong.
Let's put that to Mr. Funabashi in Tokyo. What do you think, Yoichi Funabashi, should we just engineer the environment for these nuclear plants better and actually do more nuclear power, our caller asks? Or is there some irreducible vulnerability here?
I would tend to conclude that there is inherently extremely dangerous in nuclear energy system, even though, certainly we can manage to cope with those risks, and we should do much better. But I think we really should be humble and with humility, a sense of vulnerability in dealing with that nuclear energy. When we lived through this ordeal, I think that perhaps the most crucial lesson we learned and we should learn was that we just cannot get 30 million people of Tokyo metropolitan area evacuated. So the lesson is that perhaps it is better to lessen our dependence on nuclear energy, albeit gradually. And it all depends on cost. and alternatives, viability of alternatives, and how fast and how quick we really can harness that renewable energy. So you have to be realistic. But at the end of the day, I think our goal is now very much clear.
Let's go to Kathleen in Clinton, Connecticut. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate this topic. I watched this disaster unfold with just the worst fear in my heart. I'm in Connecticut, the Northeast, and I'm on solar energy and almost energy independent. And I think that we really have to think about green energy. And this if with nuclear energy has just got to end. It's just too dangerous. My questions, though, I have a couple questions.
Yes.
First of all, what's going to happen to the spent energy in Japan if they do, and I hope they do, get off of nuclear completely? And number two, why would we think we're any safer? We have hurricanes, you know, the earthquakes. There is just too many ifs. And I would appreciate if your panelists could respond to those questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathleen. We'll look more at the U.S. situation. But Yoichi Funabashi, first to you, the spent fuel rods at Fukushima and beyond, if plants are closed down in Japan, what happens to them?
Well, I think that's exactly what we are now getting into after two or three more nuclear reactors will be shut down. Then we will not have any nuclear reactors in operation in Japan.
Amazing.
And that could really cause a lot of problems in terms of energy balance and energy supply. So I hope that that will be not be the case immediately, because I think that the graduating from that the dependence on nuclear energy, I think it should go gradually.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just cannot come up with alternatives so easily, and also you have to take account of that cost. Japan already has had to import so much gas, liquid gas, from Arab countries and the others, you know, and it cost 2 trillion yen, even
mm-hmm.
more.
Mm-hmm.
So you also have to take into account of the cost. But you also really should set a goal of graduating from that dependence on nuclear energy.
Japan has,
in your energy policy.
Japan has, as you say, paid a heavy price, but your report also describes how lucky the country was, that things are not far worse, that people in many parts of Japan can live a quite normal life today, Mr. Funabashi.
I think, yes, we are so lucky. Actually, one of the political staff to Prime Minister Khan confided to us, even though he could not say that in public, out of respect to the evacuees, how lucky we were that God is still with us in this country. Simply because, that tsunami and earthquake occurred on Friday, not on Saturday or Sunday. And the wind, the direction of the wind blowing toward the Pacific Ocean, not inland, in the 4 days immediately following the earthquake and tsunami.
Some luck right there, some tough luck as well. Yoichi Funabashi, please stand by in Tokyo. Ken Kukie with The Economist. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ken Kukie, I just wanted to ask you about Yoichi Funabashi's work with this independent commission and the kind of forthright statements we're hearing from him today. How rare, how unusual is this in a Japanese context to get this kind of, you know, post-crisis analysis?
Tom, that's a great question. It turns out that it is incredibly rare. It's extraordinary. It's actually a credit to not only Funabashi-san, who deserves that credit, but to the people around him and in that organization and the support he's getting from other Japanese, particularly Japanese elites. I want to stress that It's easy at a low level for people to join an NGO in Japan to stick their head out. But Japan is a society that doesn't really respect people who do that. And the higher up you go in the institutions of authority, the tougher it is to do that. The fact that you have both old and young, that you have people at a very prestigious part of their careers saying the things that they're doing and standing up and being counted is extraordinary. And it's actually one of the most dynamic and interesting things since World War II. It's actually a beautiful thing. I give him incredible credit for not only rallying together a group of extraordinary individuals to do this, but producing a report that is going to be historically very important and really will help revive Japan.
And not just a technical reflection, but a kind of a cultural investigation as well. We have a lot of response here online. Levi writes, he was in Japan last summer. It was incredibly hot. The country's energy-saving efforts that were required after Fukushima meant very little air conditioning. It's easy to take for granted, Levi writes, the amount of energy we consume cooling down our restaurants, department stores, trains, movie theaters. It was really hot, he writes. And with all these nuclear plants now down in Japan, that may be the case again this summer. Let's get a call. Funabashi-san, please stand by. Richard is calling from Birmingham, Alabama. Richard, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to just make a brief point and then ask Funabashi-san to expand on it, if he would.
Yes.
Americans are not known for their geographic, especially global geographic acumen. And I think it's the height of irresponsibility for our media to talk about ping-ponging back and forth between talking about the agricultural difficulties in the Fukushima area and then talking about agriculture in Japan and what's going on with agriculture in Japan and those broad brushstrokes. And I've lived in Japan a couple times. I get over there on business at least once a year, if not a couple, three times for the past dozen years. I was there this summer, too. And down in the Kanto area, which is between Tokyo and Nagoya, and then down in the Kansai area, which is starting south of Nagoya, and then down into Kyushu, the southern island.
In other words, south and west of the affected area.
This is not affecting those farmers, and we really need to emphasize that.
Richard, point taken. Though we heard Ken Kukie describe how, for the Japanese themselves, with the distribution points of milk, for example, it's hard to know what's where. What's your question for Mr. Funabashi?
That's in the Fukushima area and those prefectures around that. So my point is that our media needs to distinguish between what's going on in the Tohoku region and around Fukushima and the rest of the country, which is not affected by this.
I'll take that to Mr. Funabashi, and thanks for your call, Richard. One more right here, and I'll take it to him. Wendy in Dubuque, Iowa. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello. Actually, what I wanted to talk about touches on what the previous caller said. I'm a resident of Japan. I'm just in Dubuque visiting. But I live about 160 miles from the Fukushima area, and I was there when this all happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally haven't eaten any fresh vegetables since it happened, because when you go into the supermarkets in my rural area, all the fresh vegetables are from Japan, and a lot of them are from the northern area, from the Fukushima area. A lot of elderly people will buy it in support of the area, but I myself am a little reticent to.
Well, they buy it out of patriotism, or because they're old, they figure even if it's got a little contamination, so what? Or what? What, Wendy?
Yeah, both. In mm-hmm. support of Fukushima, and also they're old enough that it's not really going to make much of a difference. But I think there's also a lot of they just don't understand the effect that it could actually have. And there's also some rumors going on that some of the vegetables from Fukushima are being sent to other parts of Japan, like maybe in southern Japan or Hokkaido, and then distributed from that area. So the packaging will have that it's actually from a southern city in Japan, but in reality, it's from a possibly dangerous area.
Wendy, let us pick that up. Mr. Funabashi in Tokyo, what about this issue of agriculture around Japan and the level of safety or threat there? Did you look at this, and how do you assess it?
So we did not look into that matter in our report to a great extent, but I think it's a very much important issue. It's a health issue, and I think the Japanese have long been very much proud of safety and security in that country, and confidence has been very much shaken to the core, particularly because of the contamination of that the foodstuff and the others. But I think that people have now have become to be much more now comfortable with that vegetables these days, and even though there may be in some instances of repackaging and those kind of problems, but I think overall, I think that those issues are now past.
Mr. Funabashi, what do you hope for Japan's energy future? With all these nuclear plants shut down, you say you hope for a gradual change. Change to what? What source?
Change into a good, solid energy mix. I think we really should diversify our energy portfolios, but eventually I think we really should divest from our dependence on nuclear energy and perhaps also on fossil fuels. So the ultimate answer is solar-based energy, renewable energy. And I think it's doable, but it really requires a lot of money and investment. But most important, I think, part of the government, a clear signal to the market, and the government really should provide a long-term strategy. And that still has been, in my view, missing in Japan's energy policy.
Yoichi Funabashi is chairman of the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, a very prominent figure in Japan today, has just been leading this independent investigation into the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident. Yoichi Funabashi, we thank you very much for being with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. And Ken Kukie, Japan correspondent for The Economist magazine in Tokyo. Ken, thank you very much indeed for being with us.
Yes, my pleasure.
I want to bring into our conversation right now from New York City, David Biello. He's environment and energy editor at Scientific American, a big follower of nuclear energy issues around the world and in this country. He's author of an article in the current issue of Scientific American, headlined, "It's Not Just Fukushima, Mass Disaster Evacuations Challenge Planners," and that means all over the place. David, thanks very much for being with us today.
No problem. Hi, Tom.
Hi. First of all, we heard how close Japan came to seriously having to consider evacuating the biggest city in the world, Tokyo. How many Americans live within, evacuable range, if things were bad enough, of a nuclear power plant?
Well, there are kind of two zones, evacuation zones around a nuclear power plant in the U.S. One is a 10-mile radius that is expected to evacuate in the wake of an accident because they might be exposed to the kind of plume we saw at Fukushima. And then one is a 50-mile radius, which is actually the recommendation that U.S. officials gave in the wake of Fukushima for the area that might be evacuated. And roughly 180 million Americans live in that 50-mile zone, and that includes some pretty large cities in the U.S., including our largest, New York City, where I am right now, but also places like Philadelphia, San Diego, and even West Palm Beach, which I think of as more of a a more relaxed community than maybe some of those others.
Nearly all of Japan's 50-plus nuclear reactors are now shut, at least for the moment. In the U.S., we've got, 104. In Japan, they had 25% of their energy from nuclear. We have about 20% of our energy from nuclear. Are we vulnerable to the same kind, or I guess I should ask it more broadly because the same is hard maybe to imagine, but what has Fukushima taught us about what vulnerabilities we should be looking at in this country?
Well, the good news in the U.S. is that we are an extremely large country, as you may have noticed, and so our nuclear power plants are scattered around, and a problem at one is not likely to become a problem at another.
Which could have happened in Japan.
Yes, exactly. They tend to be more closely clustered together, and that was the big problem at Fukushima. Was not only were these six reactors at Fukushima Daiichi struggling, but just down the road, there was another power plant, Fukushima Daiichi, that was also struggling. And then not too far away, within that 10-mile zone, were yet more nuclear reactors. Here in the U.S., we tend to scatter them around quite a bit more. So a problem at one is not likely to be a problem at another. But we do have most of our reactors at this point are very old, and we do have a number that are exactly the same as Fukushima Daiichi. In fact, we were aiding Japan by running simulations at some of the reactors that are exactly the same, you know, these kind of computerized simulations to try to understand what was going on there.
Now, when you say exactly the same, does that mean that part of the problem in Japan was that in cooling these plants required power to keep water flowing up and into the cooling area? When the power was lost, there was no sort of gravity feed here. They weren't designed that way. Do we have that exact design here that requires
exact design here. It's called the Mark I containment. It's from General Electric, which, of course, is a storied American company. And back in the 1960s and 1970s, they were selling these reactors as cheap. Even at that time, safety regulators were quite concerned that the safety systems, as they were designed, were more about saving money than providing safety. Now, there have been some retrofits to try to help these safety systems perform better in the wake of an accident, and those retrofits may or may not have helped Fukushima in this case.
So what does that say, about the speed of retrofits? Will it happen at all of our comparable plants, or are people saying, well, they're not in an earthquake zone, they're not vulnerable to that kind of hit, so it's not required?
Well, the rules as such have not been set yet. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, this is the commission that kind of sets the rules for all the nation's nuclear power plants, is considering what needs to be done based on what happened at Fukushima. And they're starting to issue rules. Once those rules are issued, a lot of folks will have time to comment, both on the industry side and on the public side, and then we'll see what the NRC ultimately requires nuclear power plant operators to do.
George is calling from Shenandoah, Virginia. George, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I had an opportunity once to talk for a good length of time with electricians working at the Indian Head nuclear power plant north of New York City. At the time, they were employed continuously around the year to replace electrical lines within the plant. They said that essentially every nuclear power plant older than 20 years old has the same problem, that low-level radiation degrades the insulators on every single electrical line in the plant, and that even trying to replace the lines is fraught with the risk of large-scale short circuits. And I was wondering whether you'd care to comment on that, because that essentially makes every one of our plants that are older than 20 years a ticking time bomb.
Which is all of them. David, what do you say?
Well, there's no question that age is a challenge for nuclear reactors, and they kind of need this continual refurbishment. The good news is that they get that continual refurbishment, and they're required to by regulation. But the caller is right that these are very complicated machines, and unfortunately, they can be quite, temperamental, not reacting well to stress, as we saw at Fukushima. The flip side of that is that in this country, at any rate, we have thus far run our reactors pretty well for about the last 40 years.
We have 104 reactors in this country now. The two new ones approved in Georgia very recently for the first time in decades. What do you see as the future of nuclear power in this country?
It's still an open question. What we know for sure is that nuclear power plants aren't going to be built except where utilities can kind of pre-charge their customers for them. So down in Georgia, where they're building two of these new reactors, so-called AP1000s with passive safety features, as you were mentioning, they actually have gravity-fed water that will last for 3 days in the wake of an accident like Fukushima Daiichi, where you don't have off-site power, you don't need pumps to keep these kinds of reactors safe. But they are still expensive. Each one is about $7 billion and counting. And the only reason that they're being built down there in Georgia is that the state government has allowed the local utility to tack on a little surcharge to bills today so they can build up the money. The $7 billion are going to need to build these plants.
$14 billion for two new nuclear plants that that will go up in Georgia, the first in decades in this country, and with everybody looking over their shoulder at Fukushima. David Biello writes about environment and energy for Scientific American. His article in the current issue is It's Not Just Fukushima, looking at evacuations there. David Biello, joining us from New York, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And I should say for all our listeners, there are maps and video of Fukushima and its aftermath at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.